go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
The Cognitive Rampage, a scientific approach to self-discovery, change, and life optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. I definitely have been lately. Whatever that definition is to you, you know, I still have podcast remorse when I was asked by Mr. Joe Rogan, what does Cognitive Rampage mean? And in all podcast remorse, my terrible, terrible response and all my panic was, well, sometimes when I talk, I get rampagey. You know, that's a fucking terrible definition of what it meant. And I have to live with that echo in eternity of that definition. But to those of you out there, the Cognitive Rampage, really the thinking rampage, but the way I see it is to humbly question self, others, and the world in the search for competence to build growth, to live a life of enthusiasm, to find the curiosity of the child again, to frame our story to be the epic hero adventure that our lives really are. And to live your Cognitive Rampage is yours. There is no steps to follow per se, unless you want to buy my book and read that. But other than that, to live your own authentic Cognitive Rampage is to question things and ultimately question self and continue with that, not criticize self, but find a way to build on what we learn and question and know that most of what we understand is, well, really just our perception. And, well, a young man that I think understands that concept, and I've watched over the last week or two, in a short period of time, really, probably a few weeks, begin to add things to what he was doing. And Ryan Maris is on the show, a UK fighter, young guy by the looks of him. Otherwise, I just feel really old. So apologize if not, and congratulations if you are old. But welcome to the show, Ryan Maris.
Thank you very much for having me, man.
Well, let's say how you got here, to be honest. I mean, I love what you did, dude. You took an initiative. It's like, I appreciate you listening, etc. You tweeted like, one day I'll be. And I'm like, fuck that. I'm like, how about right fucking now, man? You know, doing that, just saying it, that meant something to me, because I already mentioned when Rogan did that, he did a favor for me, reached out, just it was a good message to spread. And I thought, man, part of adding to this was that is going, man, if I can get a show decent enough to where somebody wants to be on, fuck yeah, come on the show. I'm not going to be like, I don't know, how many did you write? 10 books? Are you worthy? You know, that's not what the fuck it's about. You know, everybody's life, in my opinion, is probably a movie anyway, you know. So, what made you reach out, man? Is that just kind of how you lived your life typically? You typically just say, fuck it?
Pretty much. So, I saw a Facebook video of you, of the clip of you on Joe Rogan's podcast. And I was like, wow, I like this guy. So I looked up the full podcast, started to see, I got an understanding for what you're about and what in kind of mental health and your views. I was like we're on a similar page. I was like, man. So hit up all of your social media, started following all of your content, and about creating, you know, me, but creating it yourself. So I thought, you know, I'm not afraid to message anyone on the social media. If I think I can learn something, gain an experience, you know, I'm going to dive head first for that. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to tweet him. He might not see it. He may not. And, you know, luckily for me, I was very grateful for the response. And luckily enough for me, here I am now.
I think lucky for me that people like you even watch or even take a fucking half a second out of your day to give a shit or follow anything, frankly. So the love is all out there. But I think, and then I wanted to go back to what I was talking about, right? And that's just kind of introducing everybody to how we got here, right? But and I watched in a very short period of time, man, a mental health advocate, kind of outspoken for a while, came out with a blog recently, just really started to put your own things into action.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, you know, that little project of...
I hate to interrupt you, man, but well, what moves you, right? What's fueling that, right? What's creating, I don't know, what's I don't know, fueling your rampage, your cognitive rampage?
12 or 13 years old, my dad passed away. You know, a big, huge role model in my life. I was a young boy just starting to go through puberty. My older brother, my second closest role model, you know, he moved out and I was, it was just me and my mum. And for 6 or 7 years, you know, I struggled in going to school because of the effects of my dad's death. So suffering from my own depression, my own anxiety. And when I got to about 18 or 19 years old, you know, it was made aware to me in quite unforgiving circumstances that I was actually living alone with my mum, who had a pretty severe mental illness. So for the 6 or 7 years as a young teenager, struggling with my own emotions and my own mentality, you know, things with me and my mum were quite difficult. You know, she has a disorder, but when I was growing up, I always believed it was, I thought it was paranoid schizophrenia, but it's since been re-diagnosed as like a bipolar disorder. So every day as a young teenager, despite battling myself, I didn't know what kind of person I was going to be greeted with downstairs, stuff like this, my hormones, her like chemical balance. So it made a very rocky relationship adventure. Yeah. But again, at that age, I was completely clueless.
That's a lot to deal with, man, at a young age. I mean, when, you know, Patricia and I were talking the other day about the effects of, you know, a young man that comes up without a father, what those impacts are, you know, indirectly or directly. And unfortunately, you got to be careful how you talk about each day, whether the father's missing and the father has an important role that is, which I do believe. And with that role missing, you, at that age, you actually put on this protective gear, this armor of, I got to be the man of the house now. I have to be the defender, the protector, the earner. You become a man in a matter of a few moments. And this is a traumatic transformation. And for you to take that on at the same time, nonetheless to say that anyone that experiences a true diagnosis of bipolar disorder, that is a, if not the most difficult mental health disorder to really get under control, and has leave some terrible things in its wake. Not only are you the man of the house, and how old were you?
Throughout 12 or 13, yeah. So really early on up until 18, 19.
Jesus. So at 12 or 13 years old, you're putting on the I'm the man, I'm the protector, I'm the earner, at the same time as also the caretaker, as the coach, the psychologist, the man battling so many different supposed tos of a development, Ryan. That's how old are you now, man? Jesus. So this isn't, you're kind of, you're there, man. You're still riding that wave right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm coming to terms. I'm now. I'm educated on her condition. Again, it come about pretty unforgiving, but you know, I started to really notice when I was about 18 or 19. I was in fight camp, and I was only coming back at the weekends to work. Just my absence, you know, as much as I was in my school, I was like case. You know, you don't initially understand, you know, the reliability that she has on me. You know, as much as I was, like you say, maybe a caretaker, you know, I was there for her and she's used to me being around all the time. So when I started to, you know, spend more time away, you know, her behavior really started to change. And my brother and my dad were aware of her illness, very much so. Obviously, in her childhood, in earlier in my younger childhood, I wasn't aware of she was having episodes, etc. So they were in the front of that. And one particular night really stood out to me as, you know, not kind of per se behavior. Through of this, and he said, "Oh, okay." Kind of, he put on a pretty brave poker face. And, you know, the next day, he lived quite far away. So the next day he was actually, and I was like, okay, this is a bit different. I don't know why you're here. It's nice to see you, but, you know, why are you here? Formula, you know, she's unwell. And just spiraled, you know, me and him had to work together with mental health teams here in the UK to, you know, get her the help she needed, which was to get her into hospital. With me being away, you know, changing, I think she may have stopped taking her medication, ruined that balance in her the chemicals in her brain. And that's all it takes is, you know, all it took. And me and him had to work together and get her sectioned the first time. But
yeah, man,
That's okay. I was just going to say, less than a year later, when he moved away, I was back in the same position and I had to go through the process again of getting a section, but this time I was on my own and I'm proud of the way it.
Yeah, the breakaway, once you're the only one that's there, or even if you have help, the breakaway into the next life when you're trying to make your own life becomes in the phase two or three of the trauma, as you're first the effect of the trauma, living in it, the exposure to it, then trying to break away and live your own life and branch out into it. Before we get any further, I'm unfamiliar, if you will, with the UK process of treatment. Now, I can only make assumptions, what I've read, things I know, but since you obviously have been through it from the beginning, from 12 years old, taking care of your mother all the way up through, and now as an advocate for it and a blogger for it, if you will, kind of in a real layman's terms, if you will, walk through what the basic income person, if you will, goes through when someone is dealing with a mental health issue. What's the process there?
Okay, so from mother, she had a consultant list doctor, and then they would be the one that kind of diagnosed the condition, the medication she had to help, they suppress her behavior, just suppress her in general, really. And then you'd have a, which would be kind of like the advisor, so they just kind of kept an eye on things. Balance as well also came with.
Hey, Ryan, I hate interrupting you, brother. We have there's a delay kind of happening, and with okay. The sound, you're coming in and out. So what it may be happening is, it sounds offensive, but if you cut your camera off a lot of times, it'll slow down the rate and you may get a more direct audio. And if you would kind of start over, I think what I was picking up was that it's typical you see your physician and then the physician in some sort of diagnosis or assessment then would prescribe, like over here.
So she'd have her consultant, and then
are you able to turn off your camera right there? Kind of, if you move the mouse there, you'll see a place where you can block that out. Yeah, turn it, clip it off. Yeah, if you clip the camera off, it may allow your audio to work a little better. Oh no, no, you don't have to take. No, don't have to take yourself off camera. It's if you're using the screen there in front of you, right? Just use the mouse there, and you'll see a thing pop up where you can just disable the camera so your audio will be still going. Sorry for the interruption for people watching live. Right. When the camera goes off, you'll get a much better relay, and you may be listening and not getting the delay, but it's hard for me to follow Ryan because I'm getting skips and misses of the story. So I'm going to see if we can just...
turn the camera off.
Oh, wonderful. Now take it from the top, brother, and let's see if it sounds a lot better, man.
Yes. So she has a consultant, and then she has a GP that kind of advises her and keeps on track. She initially when I was living with her, she didn't have a support team at all. She's obviously been in the system for over 20 years. And basically when she had this episode, the mental health support teams, they come forward and they said she's just been flying under the radar just enough where she didn't get any help. So me and her were kind of entitled to be a little bit more support than we did. So that was challenging. But yeah, the thing that really, I think, was the cause, which maybe triggered my rampage a little bit, was the change in the consultant. A new consultant came in. This original consultant came in. And, you know, different people have different opinions and perceptions of the conditions. And I think the diagnosis may have changed. So I think that maybe gave maybe my mum feel a bit maybe different. Maybe she wasn't as ill as she thought. I don't know. I'm not, you know, I'm not clinically training any of this, but that's kind of what the outside it kind of maybe looked like.
Interesting.
So it's very hard.
That's I see. I'm sorry I say the words like interesting, but from an observer standpoint, the fact that there's a consultant between the facility and the practitioner, I think, is unique. We don't do that here. If anybody would be a consultant, it'd be the financial people trying to get paid for it. But the fact that that came across and a change of diagnosis. So how long was the bipolar diagnosis versus the change of diagnosis with this one?
Well, originally, I think it was a schizophrenia disorder. I never was really told the official sort of, but I believe the word that kind of floats around in my head from memory is a schizophrenia disorder. I'd have to ask my brother. But then I believe to a bipolar disorder.
Okay.
So yeah, I think the medication may have changed back and forth. And, you know, I think, bless her, like, as I say, she is the victim. I think they're still struggling to find a good balance for her now, because unfortunately she still struggles with anxiety and the depression and, you know, the loneliness still. So it's just, you know, that balance, it may take a few months, it may take years, who knows, but, you know, it's a lot for them to juggle, I think.
It's a lot for you to juggle, young man. I mean, at just 21 and at 12, again, losing your father at 12, having to take responsibility of the home, look out for your mother, seek help for her like that. I'm grateful that you were able to be there for her. But now at 21, breaking into your own life, you know, going to fight camps, finding a way to get into your flow state, find health and the other things that you do. And we've talked about as well, the mental health blogging, et cetera. So I seriously see where the fuel then comes from, as you thoroughly answered that question of why you're motivated. And what I wanted to go back to was trying to understand the UK process of mental health treatment a little better. If you could, let's say, you know, it's your situation or the typical person as well, right? Just the average UK person that suffers from mental illness or maybe even addiction. What's the first step in the common process, if you will, and then walk me through that whole process, you know, as if I'm an alien trying to understand the UK process.
So I'd say the initial first step would be they have to come to understand, you know, that there's an issue. I think a lot of this back over here, I'm not too sure again like what it's like in America, but again, there's very little understanding, depending on the condition, if it's psychotic or if it's neurotic, you know. But the more psychotic conditions, I think they're much easier to see, and you know, there's a bit of a difference there, so you can kind of process something a bit differently there. So you know, the first step would be GP. Well, this is for all conditions, I believe. It'd be GP. I know that when I had my kind of depressive states and anxious states, I was taken first of all straight away to my doctor. But that was nearly 10 years ago now, and I kind of again floated under the radar. They didn't notice any behavior because I couldn't express myself. So again, I left the doctors and nothing ever come about it. No extra support, no nothing. Other than that, then once that's happened, I think they go through a stage where you get taken to a support team. So depending on how bad the condition is, you know, you either get medication or, you know, transferred to maybe, if you need the help, into a hospital or support teams around your local area. So you can go to workshops and helpful things like that. Or my mum, when she first got discharged from hospital, was she had a lot of support team. So the people would come over to the house, visit her, have a cup of tea, make sure she's taking her medication, ask about her well-being, stuff like this. But again, that's very far stretched. You know, it doesn't last long. I think it lasted maybe a month after she come out. Maybe two.
Now, who pays for all this? Is this self-pay? How's it? How's the payment work out for this?
It comes through tax. So tax from everyone's like wages from, you know, everyone's life. And it goes towards our NHS, our National Health Service. And it all gets put into one big pot. Unfortunately, that big pot has got to stretch significantly. And, you know, the little drips get to the mental health, well, everywhere really. There's a big debate about how little money actually gets put into our NHS. So there's very little funding around it, which is why it's very stretched and not everyone can receive this kind of support.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point, right? Is because, you know, everyone's talking socialized medicine over here now, right? And we copycat. Well, the UK does it, right? That's what we say. But hearing from somebody that has been through that, it seems the same problems exist. Is little funding, little research, little known, overprescribing.
Yep, exactly. And that's exactly where my fire comes as well from hashtag Mesa Let's Talk, is I believe if I can get all of this and not receive therapy or medication, you know, anyone can have any coping mechanism they wish. If it works, it works. I'm not going to judge them on that. But for me to get through what I've gone through and not, you know, take that medication or to not receive that therapy, I believe there's so many more coping mechanisms and strategies that can help people that, you know, won't drain this system, and they won't need that system, you know. So that's what I really try and push forward, is like that can maybe be a last resort, but again, it depends on the condition and the need of the individual.
Yeah, well, you're going to open up a cognitive rampage out of me with that one. But before we go walk down, you mentioned a point about under the radar, and flying under the radar for registering fully is this diagnosis or the other is a huge Let's Talk About a point if you want to talk about something, because even in the diagnosis that I've put together, athlete's depression, that is a key marker and issue in the manifestation of athlete's depression, is that length of time and under the radar. So myself even tested just below the radar when I was younger with certain things. And when you're just below the radar with mental health, you're, well, frankly, aren't offered too much help. Therapists over here are expensive to see privately. I mean, $100, $150, even if you can afford insurance. The insurance is, like you said, have the drips of money. So they cover a little bit, maybe one or two a month. But the issues about under the radar is huge with kids. So the kids that fly under the radar of actual ADHD diagnosis, not imposed diagnosis, but actual suffers from these severe issues that go under the radar, over time, they snowball and become comorbid or have coexisting disorders, where the ADHD may go under the radar. And then over time, that may just fuck the person up enough to where they don't quite get this or finish this or do that. Then over 5-10 years, this little bit under the radar has now snowballed into a major depressive disorder. And so the under the radar, brother, is, you know, the on the border, if you will, is a big issue.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of expectation for individuals to seek the help. So, you know, they're underneath that surface and, you know, exposing themselves to that kind of, you know, vulnerability is a daunting process. You know, not many people want to, you know, be on that radar because it's the attachment to the name attached to it. I think my mum maybe didn't want to, is under the radar, maybe didn't want to seek that help as well, because, you know, she's been within that system for how many years, and, you know, maybe there's a lot of bad memories of that. You know, it's a traumatic experience, and I can understand from her perspective and her condition maybe why she didn't want that kind of attention.
Yeah, it does bring a lot of negative stigma, a lot of judgment when people don't don't understand it. And people that really suffer from full-on bipolar, I know, get upset when people, they cast that diagnosis sometimes, even self-diagnose, and they have no fucking clue what it really means when they're saying, oh, I'm bipolar, oh, he's so bipolar. They throw these things out there and don't understand that it, although it is a very rare diagnosis, it is overly diagnosed significantly, it's a dangerous one. It's a difficult one. And, you know, it's tossed around as if, oh, you got that or they're this. And the truth is it's rare, but it's serious.
Yeah, it's very, very serious indeed. Like, it's, it took me a long while to, like you say, living with it and me having no knowledge of it. It was actually quite scary, but, you know, I've done a couple of podcasts now where I kind of try and share my mum's story and her perspective. And, you know, when I first started doing it, you know, she got a little bit of upset, you know, that exposure. But I have to explain to her, you know, I'm trying to kill the stigma around. So, you know, it's easier for you. So people can approach you and you can find people with common, you know, common, interests and et cetera, that understand you and you can understand them, you know. The more we don't talk about it, the harder it's going to be in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, I even, I did a podcast a little bit, a couple episodes back about the opioid epidemic. And, you know, I'm anti a lot of prescriptions. The doping, if you will, is the first line of treatment. And I will outspeak against that for a long time. But I was also wanted to be careful about not to vilify and create a war on the pills also, if you will, because then there's those that do have chronic diseases that are, that are biological that exist. Man, coffee. But, and they need those things. So it becomes more and more difficult for people to get those pills. And the pills, if you will, are science. They're where we've gotten to. And they do work for some people. You know, I'm not that naive. It does work for some people. They do it right. They take them, they titrate off of them, use them as a little hump. And that's great. People do that with supplements. They do it with HGH, right? They do their little fillers, stem cells almost in a way, right? It's some way of science that we've learned to help ourselves. But so I don't like to vilify. What I vilify is the enforcement. The first line of treatment is that, and the non-explaining that everything we're talking about in mental health, everything is theoretical. We can't x-ray you and show you that you have bipolar. We can't, you know, we're getting there with certain things, but those even can be inconsistent. Well, eventually, perhaps, but, you know, there's this incessant need to prove it to be a biological, physiological, or neurological issue, because the only way I see it is that's the only way we could fix it. So then we can make pills for it, right? Pills become the treatment if it's genetic, right? It's still a scientific treatment you'd have. And we hunt this route rather than really taking a look at social influence and these other ways to even help those that are truly affected by the mental health.
Yeah, I think, there's history in my mum's side of the family with mental illness. And I think maybe, you know, it could be hereditary. But, you know, I wish, you know, getting that understanding, especially being around it, seeing, you know, her doing really well on a certain type of pill, a doctor coming in, changing that pill, and then, you know, seeing her not be that same kind of level and competence, you know, it can be frustrating. Like, I wanted to kind of say to her, you know, why doesn't, you know, the consultant allocate pills that where you like to be the way you were before, but obviously everything changes, the chemical balance is all different, you know, it's not as simple as that. So, you know, it's a frustrating time, but, you know, I feel confident that the balance will be there. But like you say, these
so you're talking almost 10 years of medical treatment and attempt to treat with pharmacology and still have yet to even get a concrete diagnosis or pharmacological treatment?
Not really. No, yeah, I agree. I would agree with that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's right. I kind of go, Right. So, and now the genetic issue, you know, I think it was Dr. Stanton Peel we had on here talking about how they proved the idea that we couldn't just remove genes and change people like we once thought. And the genetic predisposition has come up for argument, but only that it may be present, but it won't manifest or show itself, if you will, unless the correct environment proves itself. Right. Mm-hmm. So, that's what I've been an advocate for of mental health is one, open all avenues. I'm talking psychedelics, open it all. You know, if you're willing to hand somebody a pill that may want them to kill themselves, if we're willing to go that far, hey, this pill may want you to commit suicide in some fashion randomly on a Tuesday, take it your own risk. If we'll give that, but we won't give somebody a fucking psychedelic that's never killed a mushroom that's never killed anybody, right? So for me, it's open up all the treatments, but take a closer look at the social influence. What's the environment like? What traumas has that person experienced? And find a way to change the environment to help, I guess, manifest a real change in the person.
Yeah, exactly. My mum, she's been through 10 times more than I've been through.
She has a traumatic history then.
Yeah. So in about 10 years ago, a couple of years before my dad passed away, her mother passed away. And then I think within a year after my dad passed away, her best friend passed away. Another close friend of her, which was the husband of her best friend, a year after that, he then passed away. And then just recently, a couple of years ago, my granddad passed away. So she lost both her parents, her husband, her best friend. And, understandably, that's
in her health.
Unfathomable.
Oh my God, man.
Yeah. And then as well as that, the two episodes that she had in quick succession, with people not understanding why it's happening or her illness, they just see her as that, that crazy neighbor. So they completely turn their backs. So she loses a lot of friends, and now she's got a very small amount of friends. And she's still stuck in the same place where me and my brother and all of us as a family grew up. That house has probably got a lot of bad memories for her. I know it's got a lot of bad memories for me. So, she's kind of trapped. So,
look at it. I mean, we just covered, they tried 10 years, still have no concrete diagnosis and no real effective way to treat it with pharmacology. But when we take a look at the social influence, the Gabor Mate trauma and social theories and impactors like Dr. Stanton Peale, when we look at those environmental factors, I mean, you just listed them, brother. To think that someone could take the impact of all of that loss of so much close to you while sitting in an environment. I'm an advocate, right, of if you don't like the environment, change your perception. That sounds good, but I'll call my own shit too. You can change your perception of prison all you want to, but eventually that environment fucks you up. So the environment eventually wins. It just helps bring it down a little bit. So we're looking at your mom who's just kind of stuck in the system, provides what it can with drips, but even that is institutionalization. It's going to a hospital, which is not a real environment, nor is it loving. You talked about her neighbors that have labeled her this terrible, terrible name. And so she has no social connection. And it's difficult fighting stigma at the same time. I think, man, I don't know, man. I'm really leaning toward that. I'm not anti-pharmacology. I've seen it work. Research also shows with therapy and that combined, you get results. Agreed, not denying this, but again, open it all. But man, if the environment focus, it seems, the best way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard for me watching it because obviously I'm at university. I don't live too far away, but I try to create that gap where she's not relying on me. I do get texts every day, and she's, even if I go visit within a couple of hours, she's already texted me about when I'm next visiting. But I'm trying to bridge that gap away from I'm going to have to be a little bit selfish and try and create my own life and help her in as much way as I can. But I'm just trying to allow her to be her own person, try and almost, because she's around good people, the people that she does have, she's got a good lot of support, but I think it'd be good for her to try and, see how she finds herself on her own, if she can find, I think she complains a lot about being lonely, which is completely understandable, but maybe her finding a hobby or finding another way of distracting that negative energy and channeling it in a different way, I think will be a big help for her. But, until then, I think it's very, very hard to know the future steps.
Yeah, I think most of mental health is kind of like, well, you know, that's kind of where I see where we're at. You see another a mass shooting or some terrorist attack. You see the talk of mental health, right? I mean, this is irrational. That what are we going to do? Give everybody a fucking psych test, a subjective psych test, and become the minority report and predict who's crazy? You know what I mean? Like it becomes talking points, but we do fucking nothing. We don't change anything. It's the same old guard. We talk about, well, 300 million more to mental health of doing the same old shit for this fucking long with this much mental health awareness. But yet anxiety increases, depression increases, more diagnosis because they overdiagnosed, and more pills that go toward it. Right. And again, not vilifying the pill, but fuck, you know, if I'm sorry, but if I'm looking at, you know, a fighter, and I said, look, you've been fighting 10 years. We're not really sure what weight class you are or what your foundation of martial arts is. You're 0-10 now, lost a fight each year. Maybe we should try a different thing.
Absolutely.
You know, but when there is no other thing, right? When you're just the fighter, when there is no other thing, that's the sad part, right? When we can't connect our communities, you're left to online connecting, right? Which still can be powerful. Yeah,
I think it's just so difficult. I think with the, you know, like the conditions, like the anxiety and the depression and other things, I think, you know, me and you have got a good approach. You know, that informality, that social interaction, that bringing, you know, us together as humans, you know, the natural instincts. But when you're dealing with a condition like the schizophrenia, the bipolar disorders, you know, the unpredictability of it, you know, it I feel like it's just very challenging. It's difficult, and it's they're both very, very difficult to comprehend. But there's something I don't know if I can describe it. There's something different about the psychotic conditions.
Yeah, well, that's the main marker of bipolar. See, for the morons out there, and I will call you them fucking morons, if you're the person that says or indirectly calls somebody bipolar and says, well, they're happy one minute and sad the next, you're out of your fucking mind. That's not what bipolar is. So please stop referencing people as being bipolar, or if you believe yourself to be bipolar because you think you get happy and then you get sad, stop it. That is wrong. That is not how it works. And Ryan, you'll, I'd rather get it from you, really, of what that experience is like. But as a mental health person myself, the marker of mania is the huge separation that for 2 weeks to 6 months, one must experience severe depression. I don't mean suicidal ideations. I mean plans, thoughts, interruptions type things. 2 weeks to 6 months, but the marker of mania is what creates the bipolar and the dangerous, and the most dangerous that I will say to anyone out there, that someone that is fully diagnosed bipolar in a manic, state, in my opinion, is the most dangerous diagnosis, most unpredictable. So the mania is something that is almost like, kind of like you're saying, Ron, almost indescribable. What it's risky decisions. It's you decide to wake up and paint your house neon yellow at 3 a.m. And do so, and maybe even your neighbor's house, and then feel you need to fly to Maine because someone called you or something. And these decisions become risky to life, finances, health, etc. And that needs to last also for 2 weeks to 6 months, or if they're cycling faster. Does this sound kind of what your life has been like, Ryan, for the last 10 years?
Yeah, I'd agree with a lot. Yeah, very, very impulsive behavior. Like I said, I've seen her at different levels of like medicated. So when she was kind of when I was growing up, she was kind of good, you know, but finances were the biggest issue. So very, very impulsive with money. We never really had any money. She was very, very, kind of, I don't know, she's very sociable, but in different ways. So she had a very set routine. And if that routine, you know, was disrupted, things would be, it'd be very, stressful for her. She liked to have like full control. She liked to have control over me. So as examples, when I was younger, I'd go to parties, and she wouldn't, like, she had a very weird sleeping problem. She never seemed to sleep, only during the day. It would always, she'd be up all night, she'd sleep all day. I remember going to parties at 16, 15, and she'd text me at 4 and 5 in the morning, like, I'll come pick you up. And I'd be like, why are you kind of awake? Like, kind of thing. Like, it's things that people on the outside would think, well, your mum's awesome, man. Like, that's cool. Like, why are you complaining about that? And at the time, I was like, this is okay. It's a bit weird, but okay, I'll take that. And then once I realized it's because she was so anxious of me just being safe that she had to have that control to know that, you know, I'd be going home safe. You know, you really start to doubt like how she thinks in her day to day life, how she must feel when someone she loves walks out the door and the attachment she has to that. Just the constant change in mood, like you say, it's not just happy, sad. It's there's tears, there's emotion. Some days I would be like a prince. I'd kind of say I couldn't do anything wrong. She would cherish me. She would like so much love towards me, and in a click of a like a click of a finger, I could be a public enemy number one. I could be getting abused verbally. I never received like physical abuse or anything like that, but the constant verbal abuse and the psychological abuse and the psychological cost that came with it, to then being in the next moment being this positive figure, is a very confusing time, and it forced me into my own shell. And for me not to understand that, it kind of, I think it probably made her a lot worse, because there was no one to kind of almost provide rationality for her and try and help her and support her.
Yeah, the fear of losing control of the environment, really the fear of losing control of being alone or in the state. And a lot of people that experience that are bipolar, the manic state becomes a godlike state where anything is possible, anything can change. You get real lovey. These are the things, but that once that cycle does change, it manifests into a target and can get really, really, really abusive and violent. And as a child, typically, you described your response there, is you begin not to feel anything because you can't absorb the love, because you don't believe it because of the response that you know is following. You can't allow the pain to enter either. So it really becomes hard to feel. And as you get older, be careful about, you know, becoming concrete and closed off to others in the world. You know, being vulnerable is the key, right? Allowing yourself to be open. And because it's a defense mechanism for the age and the development at the time that you're experiencing. But as you get older, that's something that ends up weighing you down.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a scary time. But all throughout my, from my earliest, from about 12 to 14, I was very like aggressive, dark, placid, like you say, emotionless, a lot of the time. And I think, I'd snap at people, and I just wasn't a very nice person to be around. And then when I hit, I'd say 16, 17, 18, it almost flipped reversed. I became a kid. I was the child I should have been when I was 12. I become very energetic, very hyper, very kind of happy-go-lucky, a bit of a clown in school. And I just... I wanted to be around people. I remember I'd walk through school and I'd walk a certain way where I knew there'd be more classrooms where people could see me. And I just wanted to be seen and known. I wanted that identity. So watching that transition as well was very bizarre. And again, because I never went to a therapy or a doctor or anything like that, it was all things I just figured out and observed myself. So yeah, you was absolutely spot on that suppression of emotion. Was a very dark time, very lonely time. I spent a lot of my teenage years alone, and finding comfort within myself and trying to, you know, find that inner love.
Yeah, and then when you get outspoken and you realize, oh man, is that what attention feels like? You know, because when you're born into, you're not the center of what's happening. And then you see that for the moment, laughter class clown gets us that. That response goes, holy shit, that's new, right? What the six-year-old felt from the loving or compassionate, whatever was happening, or attention, you got to experience in a social setting. And then when you get that reward, you're like, oh shit, you know what I mean? I need more of that. And in the humor, let's see if I can remember how I used to say it. There's five ways that humans cope with things. It's indifference, right? We just, ignorance, right? We just ignore it and say, it's not even happening. Sometimes we numb ourselves out. We use things to distract us or whatever. We cast blame. We blame somebody else or, I only did this because you did it, right? Et cetera. Or we get angry is the other response, right? And, or we get within our shell and we disappear and we don't talk to anybody. Isolation is another way that we respond to it. But our coping mechanisms that we learn, and the other one is humor. That's the one that I was leading up to, is we use humor is to cope with something. But behind humor actually is tears. And I used to talk about that when I'd get the class clown and as a client or something. And I know right behind that laughter is actually really tears. And a lot of times you'll see somebody, man, they'll go from laughing and joking and then they're just kind of just bawling.
Yeah. The experience in myself has made me a very observant person. So now when I see people, I'm around people, you see the exterior skin they put on, but now I've know what I've experienced, I can see things within them. And I think that's why people find me quite relatable, because I've always had quite an observant mind. And this time alone, like say the isolation, I used to go for early morning runs. I used to go long walks on my own with my music in. And I just used to just think, I just used to try and process. And I think that isolation and that that trial and error of thought processes, I think that's what kind of brought out the mentality that I have today. And just that open mind.
What is your philosophy today, Ryan?
Pardon?
What is your philosophy today?
My philosophy today is I just never know. You never know what's around every corner. Like I say, everything I've been through, I just appreciate every day, appreciate every struggle. My philosophy pretty much, I would say, is that, adversity is your worst, is your best friend, and also your adversity is like worst nightmare. So I know now that any adversity that comes at me, I can 100% conquer. 100%.
Yeah. When you're 21 talking like that, man, that's when you became a man at 12.
Yeah. I really focus on balance. I think the most important thing is balance in life. So the things I try to advise people on, I get messages quite a lot. So it's quite flattering that people come to me just for advice. I don't give any clinical advice or anything like that. I push them towards the help I think they need, like the signposting for like doctors or things like that, or just to talk to their family. But, when they come to me, I always ask them first, like, what's missing? What do you do and what don't you do? So this idea that, they might have an amazing work life, they're making lots of money, they have a good family life, but what do they do to stimulate other parts of their brain? So what are they doing as a hobby? Are they challenging themselves in other areas of life? What's missing? What can they improve on? I think once you find that balance, it can benefit you with relationships. It can benefit you in, your inner peace. It can benefit you in your communication, everything, every little element.
Yeah, good question to ask too is when people are feeling that certain way, a lot of times what they're not aware of is the mind state that we're in is giving us something. Now, someone may say, I don't want to be depressed. Who would want to do those things? But a lot of times it does give us something to hold on to, something to say, hey, this is how I'm experiencing life. This is what I'm going through. So at least it is my existence, right? At least this is something of my trial, my story. And, being able to look at someone and say, well, it sounds rough. I know I'll get an email, I'm sure. But what is that other side giving you? What is that isolation giving you? Because let's look at when you were younger, you developed into morning runs on your own. You learned to find comfort in the isolation, right? Over time, that isolation can end up being something that's harmful to people, right? So if anyone's switching out of isolation or trying to, connect back into community, I would say the same thing you just said, but also say, well, what is that darkness giving you that the other side can also give you, right? Is it giving you the alone time to meditate, to think? Maybe meditation can supplement this, right? And finding ways to, Dr. Carl Hart says it a lot, is in Gabor Mate too, is what does the drug give you? What is the heroin giving you? What is that addiction giving you? Find what it's rewarding you and begin to find other ways to reward that system and then connect yourself socially and deal with the trauma at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting to see over the years, like what little piece, like I would never, ever be ungrateful or like just unhappy about my past, because the past has made me who I am, and I'm grateful for every little obstacle that I've been through. I just wish there was kind of a happier process for my mum. But you know, I feel like I'm doing okay. I'm doing good. Obviously everyone has their bad days. But I've got a good support network around me. I also understand why I might be feeling the way I am now. So being able to look back and, you know, help some people, you know, it brings me a lot of happiness to know that my experience, you know, is worthwhile. You know, what I've been through, you know, there is maybe a reason for it.
Yeah, well, the reason is your mom and your own life and those around you, and anybody you talk to or share this with, man, whatever comes out, it's all kinds of help. And sharing your story is helpful to yourself too. It's helpful to get out there and say, hey, I'm this is my life. Here's what I'm walking through and living. And that's a powerful thing for everyone, for you who's sharing it, those that listen to it, those that share it. So none of those things we experience necessarily go in vain, if you will. I had a thought, man, over the 10 years, you know, around your mom, seeing so many things, what was she doing when you would say she was at her best? And what was she doing when you perhaps would say she was at her worst? As far as treatment goes, as far as treatment and socially, professionally, everything, like kind of walk through, you know, those two.
So treatment-wise, I knew she was taking her medication every day. You'd see her take it again. As a young kid, I never processed why that might be. I just thought it was paracetamol. She'd take her medication every day. She'd be in her routine, but socially, she was very energetic, very happy. She would go see her friends on her own. She didn't come across like. There was no negative side to her. There was no kind of biting behavior, like a snappy behavior. There was no, she was constantly around people. She would always be, if she wasn't with someone in person, she'd always be on the phone because she had like those kind of connections. She was nice to me. And at her worst, you know, well, actually, as a positive, she blended into society. You could see she could just blend into society, and she'd kind of be, you wouldn't suspect a thing, is obviously it.
Sorry to interrupt you, Miller. So at the best time of her life, then, she was taking her medication regularly. Now, was this early into treatment, middle, or later into treatment?
I'd say this was early, yeah. So, from the age of 12, after my dad died, yeah, I'm going to go from where my dad died as like the kind of starting mark from when I started to, it was a little bit of a process, obviously her own bereavement, but you know, people got her on track. So yeah, she was frequent with her medication at that point. I don't know what she was like when my dad and my brother were around. But from what I experienced, like from my younger years, even when I was a kid, actually, when my dad was around, you know, I wouldn't suspect a thing. She was, like you said, loving, happy, energetic.
So things were great, and then the environment changed, and a possible predisposition then revealed itself at the loss of a husband, at the loss of things around her. The environment changes, then a possible predisposition of bipolar shows itself early in the treatment at your younger age. She's socially connected and involved, and was diagnosed bipolar, I believe, early, like you said, and was on the proper medication and was socially connected, doing those proper things, and was at her best.
Yes, yeah, so she was at her best, I'd say, from the age of 12 to, I'd say, 18 was when I was unaware, but that's when the label of like this paranoid schizophrenia kind of disorder was kind of floating about. That's what I believe my brother informed me of, and my dad. But once like you said, this environment changed over the years. It wasn't just immediately after that, like this full 6-year process or so of this environment continually changing, of her son's moving out, the people around her dying. It was then at, when I was 18, 19, that then that's when she hit her worst. That's when she either stopped taking her medication, and this new behavior started to surface. And that's when this diagnosis of bipolar came about, which, you know, again, since then, things have never been the same. But that worst behavior was...
I'm sorry, man.
Okay. That's when, you know, things started to change, maybe socially, losing those friendships, not having her sons around her support network, that comfort of knowing that the people around her are safe, that they can protect her, that financial stability. You know, I was working 2 jobs at 19 and providing her some money to help towards the house, etc. You know, I think that, again, that financial stability going, yeah, the like you say, I think the nail on the head there with the environment changing, you know, it completely altered things.
All of a sudden, there's a new diagnosis. So rather than the practitioner, consultant, or physician observing the loss, the environmental change, let's just focus on the symptoms and call this, a new mental health disorder, new medications, and it all goes downhill because it must be this new diagnosis. It can't be that the environment is there and she lost 4 people close to her.
That's where some of the rampage comes, because at that point, diagnosis, that's where the new consultant came in.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I don't get sued.
Fuck them. Trust me, they won't. Most of them won't, because they know they're killing people somewhere, whether it's on accident or by it's not, and I'm not saying them, is that they're setting out the process, you know, the setup of the process or the lack of help is what does it, not them. They're not vindictively setting out to do it. So I have to clear that. But the process does. And along the way, there's a lot of shit that gets in trouble. A lot of times I thought I was going to get sued talking about these addiction facilities, but no one said a fucking word. And I'm like, because you're guilty as fuck. because I put your name out there 4 times on Joe Rogan and motherfuckers didn't even send me a cease and desist letter. You know what I mean? Because you know that shit's right. You know they're doing it. So, but a lot of times they don't, you know, want to get involved.
Yeah, I just feel like I'm in a completely different stage to most people. So most people are trying to establish, you know, the meaning behind the journey and the mental health side of it, and just establishing, you know, the condition. Whereas this roller coaster, you know, I think I've got a lot more experience than most people, and that's where mine and my brother's rampage comes. You know, he was the one that kind of pointed out to me, you know, the consultant changed, and you know, it made me start to think. You know, it was at that point where things started to change. And
what did the new consultant do? What was the change? What was different?
That was the change in
what was their change? Did they change the approach of the other consultant? What was the approach change?
I have no idea, unfortunately. I think my mum liked to play that quite close to her chest. Like you say, she gets quite sensitive when her diagnosis is discussed. Sure. But I remember when she informed me of this new diagnosis, she was like very happy.
Hmm.
You could tell her like outlook had changed, that maybe, you know, it's not as big of an issue as she thought.
And this is recent then?
Yes.
Because you're talking at 18, 20, she was at her worst, and you're only 21. So this is what, within the last year or two?
Yeah, 3 years, 2 years, yeah.
Holy shit. So the new consultant came in and she's doing well now.
She's, it's that rocky path that she's struggling to find that balance. Like I say, she's got no one around her. I think there's a lot of, as understandably as it would, there's a lot of anxiety and depression within there as well. So you may be looking at different conditions in there as well that, you know, she's on the antidepressants and stuff like that. But, you know,
it's creating your message though, right, man? I mean, you're there, you're thinking about her. Hell, we're talking about her now, right? So her experience is not meaningless to anything, right? That people out there are experiencing what she is, or especially what you are, man. So many times the caretakers are pushed to the side. If you're the one taking care of your aging parents, or if you're the one taking care of your sick partner, right, or your mother, if you're the child doing that, the caretaker, the husband, the wife, so many are caretakers at so many ages and levels, and the caretakers are so many times pushed aside because the focus becomes on the patient, on the person. And the caretaker, many times, my friend, ends up experiencing some equal edges of depression.
Yeah, absolutely. I went through some dark days, but I think the main thing that I felt was the guilt and the anxiety. I remember one of the first times I went on a podcast and I shared my like story publicly, the anxiety I felt when I come off of that mic was like spine, like chilling. I again, like that thought of, I've just exposed my mum. Is there going to be more stigma around her? Is she going to, like, am I going to get sued for exposing certain things? Are people going to look at me in a different light, like in a negative light? You know, all these different thoughts that come through. I just felt, because I know I had just thrown myself out in this in the open and made myself vulnerable, but I know that I can stand strong in that open space and take the hits if they're there.
Could we say that perhaps what happened at 12 created, I don't know, perhaps the ability in you to do what you just said and go out there anyway, right? To go anyway. I did a little video about the difference between courage and bravery. Courage is you go when you know what will happen, and bravery is, well, you go anyway, even though you know what will happen. And, you know, that's bravery, man, at that age. And could we say, though, that what you experienced from such a young age allowed you, if you will, or created or funded or seeded you to be able to step out and say, hey, fuck it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was, admittedly, I think a lot of it was just autopilot, just that instinct. But I don't tend to give myself like credit because, you know, it could happen to anyone. And I think just it was more of a self-discovery adventure for me as well as everything else that happened. But I'm great.
That is one of the best motherfucking reframes I ever heard in my life. You know how many people have been through what you went through in some sort of fashion, way, shape, or form, do not tell the story in some summary of that beautiful testimony? It comes out as my fucking dramatic life with my bipolar person. The way you describe that, brother, is strong and is brave, and it takes courage to live that way, man.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think people, a lot of people feel hard done by when they're in this kind of position where they don't see the opportunity and the positives that come with it as well. And admittedly, it took me a while to find it as well.
What gets you through, bro? What gets you through, Ryan? How do you fuel you? You know what I mean? I know why you're doing the rampage. I get that. I see where you and your brother's cognitive rampage is fueled to get out there and bring awareness, break some stigmas. I love it. But what fuels you personally to keep you going, man, through this battle? You know, what's worked for you, man, as a caretaker to that, an advocate of that?
I know how I used to feel, and I know that I never want to feel like that again. I know I don't feel like that, and I'm just grateful. I know what it's like to feel just happy within myself. So I'm always constantly looking to improve and develop as a person and as a human. And just keep trucking forward. You know, I take pride in, you know, when I was a young kid, after all this shit, my only aim in life is I just wanted to be the toughest kid in school in terms of fighting. I just wanted to be tough. I just wanted to be able to fight. And then, you know, all these years later, I can sit here and I think, I always was the fucking toughest kid in school, but I was a born fighter. And it's not in terms of not the sport, it's me as person. So that's how I go about it. And, you know,
don't quit on that shit, man. You had me hype with it, man. That was yeah, you see me throw my arm up over here. That was good. I like that shit. What age were you, man, when you realized you were actually the toughest kid in school for what you've been through and been doing?
Literally two years ago, once that real shit storm happened. And I at 19 I'd got my mum's section twice. I'd gone through some pretty tough life transitions on my own. I learned to be independent. I kind of looked back in hindsight and I was like, man, there was never a doubt. There was never a doubt.
If you could, for a moment, man, before we wrap up the podcast, man, talk to two people, if you will, with this question or response or rampage. If you could talk to the 12-year-old that may be experiencing or has experienced, maybe they're grown now, but experienced the loss of a father or a mother at a young age and had to become the caretaker to their mother. If you could talk to that boy or that girl first and what you'd tell them, and maybe imagine in the same room next to them is, well, what would be your mother in that story to them, the one they're taking care of, and what would you say to that person, man?
I'd say you're a warrior. You're not alone. Talk to everyone. Talk to people. You know, you don't deserve to be backed up in the corner at that age, fighting that kind of battle without some sort of cavalry. You know, it's not the way as humans you should be. You know, you're part of a human race where, you know, people should be helping and reaching out for you, and you should tackle that fight together. You know, don't be afraid to ask for what you deserve.
And to the one that now is perhaps would be your mother in this story, to that boy or girl you were just speaking to that may be about to embark on the journey that your mother is currently on, what would you say to that person?
That's a lot difficult. I'd say keep doing what works for you. Trust as much as you can in the people around you. Know that no matter what, there's people around you that love you and cares for you. And again, you know, keep trudging forward and love yourself for who you are.